Good morning. If you are able, would you please stand for the reading of the word? Today I'll be reading 1 Samuel 18, verses 1 through 5, and it says this. After David had finished talking with Saul, he met with Jonathan, the king's son. There was an immediate bond between them, for Jonathan loved David. From that day on, Saul kept David with him and wouldn't let him return home. And Jonathan made a solemn pact with David, because he loved him as he loved himself. Jonathan sealed the pact by taking off his robe and giving it to David, together with his tunic, sword, bow, and belt. Whatever Saul asked David to do, David did it successfully. So Saul made him a commander over men of war, an appointment that was welcomed by the people and Saul's officers alike. The word of the Lord. You may be seated. We've been going through this series, going through 1 Samuel. We've been approaching it by looking at kind of the key characters in the story. And today, we're going to look at Jonathan. Now, Jonathan's an interesting character because he's not a main character. He's a secondary character. And his role in the story of Samuel is to be this kind of contrasting figure. You know, everybody thinks of Saul and David as opposites, right? Like, you can compare Saul and David to each other and come up with all these differences where, you know, David succeeds, Saul fails, etc. But whenever Jonathan enters into the story, he's actually used as a tool to compare. He's used as a tool to contrast. And what the author of Samuel does is he uses Jonathan to really highlight Saul's failures and affirm David's righteousness. Last week, we talked about the story of Goliath. You know, that's probably one of the most well-known stories of the Bible. If you go out into the world and ask people, tell me a story from the Bible, right? The story of David and Goliath is one that anyone can tell you about. But there's this key moment in the story of David and Goliath where David goes to Saul. He tells the king, you know, I will fight Goliath. And Saul says, okay. And he wants to prepare David to fight Goliath. So he gives David his armor. Right? It's the scene where David is wearing Saul's clothes. And right here, in the passage we just read, we have a similar situation. Except David's not wearing Saul's clothes. He's wearing Jonathan's clothes. See, anytime you're in a narrative in the Bible, you need to be on the lookout for repeated themes, right? The biblical authors love to do this. They'll take, you know, an image or a situation, and they'll repeat it over and over and over and over again. And this isn't a coincidence. This isn't something that, you know, we're just looking too much into, right? This is what the authors did with intention all over the place. And the author has these two pictures of the exchanging of clothing because he wants to really highlight a contrast between Jonathan and Saul. See, when David goes to King Saul and says, I'm going to fight Goliath, Saul gives him the armor. At that point, David has already been anointed. Right? David has already been told, essentially, that he will become the next king. Now, I don't really think that's public knowledge. I don't think David's going around telling everybody, you know, I've been anointed as the next king, right? But when we come to Samuel and we read it, we, as the audience, know David is for sure going to be the next king. So when David goes to the king and says, I will fight Goliath, it's this moment of tragic irony. You see, Saul should have been the one to fight Goliath. Saul is the king of Israel. He should be leading his people in battle, right? And the Bible takes all of this time to highlight just how big and buff Saul is, right? He's taller than everybody. He's strong. He's powerful. He's mighty in battle, right? There's absolutely no reason why Saul should not be the one to fight Goliath. And yet he doesn't. And here comes this young man, David, who's small, and he says, I will fight Goliath. It's this moment of tragic irony where the king of Israel is not only failing to do what he should be doing, but he knows that he will not be king forever. His line will not be king forever. Saul is headed on a trajectory towards kind of permanent failure. We already know this. Whereas David has this whole bright, hopeful future. We know he's going to be the next king. He's been anointed. And so he goes to Saul. He says, I will fight Goliath. And he's wearing the king's own armor. Saul doesn't know it yet, but he's looking at the man who's going to replace him. And the man who's going to replace him is wearing his own armor, doing his own job. It's a sad moment of tragic irony. And this moment of tragic irony repeats in the passage we just read in 1 Samuel 18, where Jonathan and David meet, and they become wonderful friends, filled with love for each other. And Jonathan, who loves David so much, wants to care for David, makes this pact with him. And to show how serious this pact is, he gives David his clothes and his sword and his bow. And so we now have this other moment of tragic irony, because David's not just replacing Saul, David is replacing Jonathan. When a king dies, who becomes the next king? The son of that king. Jonathan is the son of Saul. Jonathan has far more right to become king than David does. Yet we know Jonathan's not going to be king. It's going to be David. And so there's this moment of tragic irony where Jonathan is giving his clothes to David. David is wearing the clothes of the son of the king. He's going to be the king right before Jonathan's eyes. But there's a key difference between these two scenes. One scene is a almost sad, cringe-like moment of tragic irony. And the other scene of tragic irony is actually heartwarming and hopeful. And the key reason why these two moments of tragic irony are different, why one is bad and one is good, is the reason that led to the exchanging of clothes. See, Saul was afraid of Goliath. Saul loved his own life, wanted to hold on to it. He didn't want to put his own life in danger. Saul did not trust God. He did not believe that God was there with him. He did not believe that God would care for him and lead him into victory in battle. And so he sat afraid and let this young man come and show everyone the promises of God. Jonathan, on the other hand, is not a man filled with fear. He's not a man who loves his own life. The reason why he gives his clothes to David is because he loves David. It's not an act of fear. It's not an act of self-preservation. It is an act of pure generosity and love. And there's this key line in this passage that we just read. It says that Jonathan loved David as he loved himself, in verse 3. Now, when you hear that phrase, when you hear that line, what does it make you think of? Are these not the exact same words that Jesus used? And again, this is another repetition of theme, right? When a man goes to Jesus and asks Jesus, Rabbi, what is the greatest commandment? Jesus responds with the Shema. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But then Jesus says this, he adds a line, and he says, the second is just like it, for you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That was said with intention. When you engage with the Bible and you come across this story in Samuel, or you're reading the Gospels and you hear Jesus say this, these two moments in the Bible are connected. So when you read one, something should trigger in your brain that makes you think of the other. What does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? When Jesus says that line, It can be kind of confusing. How do we know what that means? Well, the Bible actually already told us what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. Because here in 1 Samuel, far before Jesus ever arrives onto the scene, Jonathan is the shining example of what it means to love another person as yourself. See, sometimes we hear that line, to love your neighbor as yourself, and we think that it's this, like, game of weights, right? Where we love ourselves this much, and we need to make sure that we love other people, like, just as much, right? That we need to weigh, like, our selfishness with our selflessness. And we need to make sure that those are equal, because if they're not, then something's wrong. But that's not what loving your neighbor as yourself really means. Jonathan here in this passage does not balance selfishness with selflessness. Jonathan, in this passage, is filled with humble, self-sacrificial love. Right? Again, this is a moment of tragic irony. Who should be the next king? Jonathan. Who is Jonathan talking to? His replacement. In any normal circumstance, there should not be love in this scenario. There should be hatred. Human history is filled with kings and dictators and leaders who eliminate any threat to their power. Generation after generation, culture after culture, this is the history of humanity, that those in power do everything they can to hold on to power. Yet Jonathan has no concern for himself in this passage. He looks at his replacement right in the eyes and says, I love you and I will care for you and I will make a pact with you and all that I have is yours. See, when we look at this passage and we ask ourselves, what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? We come to find that loving your neighbor as yourself means that when you see something good for another human being, it's as if you are in their shoes. Loving your neighbor as yourself is not putting other people in your shoes. It is putting yourself in the shoes of another. When Jonathan looks at David, he sees every good thing that happened to David as a true and genuine joy for himself. Jonathan rejoices when David succeeds. And here's another contrast with Saul. The more David succeeds and the more people love him, Saul becomes more afraid. Saul becomes filled with jealousy and envy, and he tries to kill David. But the more that David succeeds and the more people love David, Jonathan receives even greater joy. Jonathan is not threatened. He rejoices as if people were loving him. He rejoices as if it was his own success. That's what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. That when you look out into this world and you see another who succeeds, you rejoice. When you see something good happen to another, that it fills your heart with love. What this is a true illustration of is a complete rejection of selfishness. There's no weight. There's no game to be played here. Loving your neighbor as yourself is not just making sure that you love people just as much as you care for yourself. Loving your neighbor as yourself is completely doing away with any self-concern. And you love the other people around you so much that when they succeed, when they rejoice, when they're filled with cheer, so do you. That you feel, that you take on the exact same events. And going all the way back into the creation account, God looked at man and he said, it is not good for man to be alone. There is something built into our DNA. That we were designed not to be self-sufficient, isolated creatures, but we were designed from the very beginning to be connected with other human beings. And the entire story of the Bible is that when we sin, we are hurting and harming those other human beings. That we look at a creature made in the image of God and we say, you are not made in the image of God. You exist for my pleasure. But when we follow God and when we serve him, we're not just doing, just fulfilling a checkbox. We're not just adhering to the rules. When we do something right and righteous and we follow and serve our God, we are benefiting humanity. Look at all the things that Jesus calls us to do. Look at all the things that Paul calls us to do, how the church should live. Look at the fruits of the Spirit. Right? These are qualities that are not about you. Right? If you take on the fruits of the Spirit, if you're filled with love, joy, peace, and patience, right? Kindness and gentleness, that's not to just make your life better. It's that your life makes the lives of others better. This was the entire life of Jesus, that though he was God, he did not consider equality with God as something to be clung to, but instead gave up his divine privileges, made himself into a human being to be like us and to walk with us and to talk with us and to die for us. The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus was an act of selfless love for us, not for his own gain, but for us. And my brothers and sisters, you and I were created that we would love in the same way, that your life exists not for you, but for the people around you. That God has designed this world and he has designed us in such a way that our purpose is to share and build each other up. And when we do so, we create a world where everyone is elevated and everyone is lifted up and everyone lives good lives because we are all in pursuit of the service of each other. Just as God had no reason to make us, and yet he did. Had no reason to save us, and yet he did. That this God is love, and he lavishes his love on us. So he calls us to do the same. And this is the ultimate failure of Saul, and the ultimate achievement of Jonathan. Saul was so concerned with his own life, his own accomplishments, his own achievements, that his story ends in tragedy. That Saul is a failure of a human being. And I don't mean that in hyperbole. Saul completely failed to fulfill his purpose as a human being. Not as a king, as a human being. He failed in that he rejected his God and put himself above others. Whereas Jonathan shows us how a human can live as the image of God. Because even when he was looking at his enemy, he's looking at his replacement right before him. He's filled with love. That he exchanges his clothes. This is what Jesus does. Jesus exchanged his righteousness and gave it to us. And he took on our sin. Right? That is this picture of Jonathan and David, the heir to the throne, royalty giving his royal robes to some shepherd boy. Right? When we interact with the story and we see the character of Jonathan, It points us to the character of Jesus. And when we see the character of Jesus, then you and I should be compelled to live in a similar manner. That it doesn't matter what you have, and it doesn't matter what you want. You exist to love. You exist to love with humility, to abandon pride for the service of another. That when another rejoices, you take on that joy, even if it's a setback for you. I just recently, my wife and I heard some news about some of our dear friends. And I was honestly put to the test in this way. We found out this news, and it was good for our friends, but it was deeply sad for us because they're moving away and we wouldn't be able to see them anymore. And just this week, I was put to the test with this notion that I can either rejoice for this good thing and this good opportunity for my friend, or I can be selfish at the loss that I am experiencing. Right? And this is just a minor example, but it's an example that I think all of us experience. And that when we look at the life of another human being, are we filled with joy at their achievements? Or do we look at their life kind of in a filter of how they benefit us? Because the true way to see your fellow human beings is not to see how they benefit you, or what you can get from them, but it's to look at them and to ask, how can I lift them up? How can I love them and be filled with joy for them? Just as Jesus looked at his disciples and he got down on his hands and feet, he got down on his hands and knees and washed their feet. That is the call for us today. That when we remember the person of Jonathan, we would be reminded of this humble love, a humble love that we are called to live out. Would you pray with me? Dear God, we thank you for bringing us to this place this morning. God, help us to live this out. Your word says you are love, that you've shown your love to us. You've shown it time after time after time after time again. So God, mold us and form us to duplicate that love, to spread that love. God, do all that you can in your spirit to burn away our pride, to burn away our selfishness. And God, help us to see other people the way that you want us to see them. We love you and we thank you. It's in your son's name we pray all these things. Amen.